May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant James Hall. The trial court abused its discretion in this case when it allowed the prosecutor to unnecessarily elicit testimony that one of Mr. Hall's nicknames was Nasty Nate. The trial court also allowed the prosecutor to unnecessarily refer to Mr. Hall as Nasty Nate during his closing arguments.
You say one? Was there evidence that he had more than one nickname?
Nate. Nate and Nasty Nate were his two nicknames.
But his given name is Nathan?
It's James Nathaniel Hall. But he goes by Nate and apparently Nasty Nate. Not only did the name Nasty Nate have a lack probative value in this case, it also strongly suggested a criminal disposition given the nature of this case. Prior to trial, the prosecutor said to the judge that there would be multiple references to the nickname Nasty Nate because it was necessary to establish identity and that a lot of the witnesses knew him by that name. He also said it was the basis by which the identification process or the investigation unfolded. However, he later noted that the actual name used to identify Mr. Hall as a suspect was Nate rather than Nasty Nate. There were two events in this case, just to give some context here. One occurred when the alleged victim, Mr. Bush, was confronted by a man he never knew. But there was supposedly an attempted robbery on the front porch where Mr. Bush got the upper hand and the man took off. When the man's hoodie came off, according to Mr. Bush, he heard children in the neighborhood yelling, "Nate, Nate." And then he also testified that he had learned that his name on the street that night was Nasty Nate.
Were the children yelling Nate or Nasty Nate?
Well, that's what's not very clear in the record, to be quite frank.
Well, is there some evidence that they were Nasty Nate?
Yes, Ms. G actually testified to that. Now, what's interesting, it's actually not in the record because the trial court said that, for whatever reason, found that it was hearsay what the kids screamed. So when Mr. Bush testified that they yelled, "Nate, Nate," she's told the jury to disregard that as hearsay. And when Ms. G said they said, "Nasty Nate, Nasty Nate," she told them to disregard that as hearsay. But the testimony unfolded that Mr. Bush told the police the name was Nasty Nate. But the police officer put Nate in the database and came up with Mr. Hall as their suspect.
So I guess your first point is the judge was persuaded to allow the defendant to be referred to as Nasty Nate on the basis that it was needed for identification, whereas in fact it was not.
That's correct.
And number two, the prejudice resulting from the use of that moniker outweighed the zero probative value that it had. Is that your?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Well, is it your position then is that the use of the word nasty would have persuaded the jury or misled the jury into a conviction despite evidence that would have shown either innocence or at least create reasonable doubt, that one adjective?
Yes, Your Honor, because of the number of times it was used and the fact, the way it was used during closing. And the definition of nasty includes causing severe pain or suffering. And the charge, which
isn't that undercut by the fact that the jury acquitted on some charges?
No, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. Because he was acquitted of for the first incident. No one reported that to the police that night. What happened was there was a second incident 2 days later where Mr. Bush said he thought it was the same person that assaulted him or tried to rob him 2 days earlier. However, he gave one description of what the man was wearing. Ms. G supposedly saw the man shortly thereafter and gave a different description of what he was wearing. And the police arrested a man that was wearing even something different, and that man turned out to be Mr. Hall. So there is an explanation there that the police were involved in that occasion, and the person that they arrested turned out to be Mr. Hall, whereas that was not in the, did not occur 2 days before, and that was not reported to anyone. So
you referred to in your brief, to, I assume it's a grade B movie called Half Baked.
Yes, Your Honor.
And Nasty Nate was a character in that movie. Was that argued below? to the trial judge that
no.
because of the movie or half-baked?
No, it's simply an illustration as to one of many inferences somebody could draw. For example, in these other cases that have been cited, the one dealing with the nickname Mauser, which is, I guess, a German name, a German type of a gun, I mean, that was just an illustration as to what people could draw the inference as to, well, he has a German gun. If, you know, if this is his nickname, he must use it. Same thing with Bert.
Let me bring up another movie if we're going to talk Hollywood. Detective Harry Callahan in the movie Dirty Harry had the nickname Dirty Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the explanation in the movie was not that Harry was a dirty cop or a corrupt cop.
Mm-hmm.
It was he had to do every dirty job that comes along.
Yeah.
Well, is it necessarily a prejudicial inference that's drawn? Nasty Nate could be a hardworking construction worker that gets his hands dirty.
Right, but I think a couple of things. First of all, there was an explanation as to why his nickname was Dirty Harry. In this case, the judge agreed with the defense attorney that the name Nasty would provide an inference with respect to his conduct, his actions, versus, for example, the way he looked.
Which conduct? I mean, Nasty could also suggest that the man, you know, didn't take a bath as often as he should.
That's correct. The problem is that there are several different interpretations of that. And what I would say is this. The fact that during the prosecutor in his closing, I think, is what made it very difficult, problematic in this case, because the prosecutor said at one point that and pointed to the defendant and said, I'm assuming he pointed to the defendant, James Nasty Nate Hall is sitting in that defense chair right now because he tried to rob Alex Bush. So he referred to him by that name and said that he was sitting there because he committed these crimes. And he also mentioned his nickname several times. The problem with it is that if you've got somebody who the people can identify by one name, and there's a process by which they can do it, and the defense attorney actually suggested that process to the court, and she denied it, and it's not relevant to anything. And it's even if it's because he's dirty, doesn't take a bath, or what have you, it's definitely not relevant. Now, with respect to the prejudice, I think that comes through.
Even though he was identified by the alleged victim as Nasty Nate.
He in court, he told, here's what happened. In court, he said, when he was asked who did this, he said, James Nathaniel Hall. He said that twice. He then said he heard the kids say Nate. He then said, upon further questioning, the name that he was known by on the street that night was Nasty Nate. And he passed that name along to the police. He didn't really identify him by Nasty Nate. He passed along hearsay, and the police put Nate in. So Nasty Nate had nothing to do with the investigation process. It was completely irrelevant in this case.
As a matter of historical fact, it was the name given to the police.
Yes. But that name was not used to identify Mr. Hall as the suspect. The name Nate was. The police officer put Nate in the database, got Mr. Hall's picture. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. First, I'd like to just clear up the record a bit. The James Hall and Alex Bush, according to Alex Bush, had never met. He had seen him in the neighborhood but had no idea who he was, this being Alex Bush having seen James Hall in the neighborhood and having no idea who he was. The first interaction between the pair was on the night of November 6th when James Hall attempted to rob Alex Bush. During that encounter, after the gun went off, the children on the scene screamed either Nasty Nate, or Nate, Nate. Tracy G., the owner of the home, who was inside the house, heard.
Was that evidence before the jury, or was it stricken?
It was stricken, Your Honor. But it does go to inform how this was relevant to the state's prosecution of Mr. Hall.
As a background fact.
As a background fact, yes, Your Honor.
I'm a bit confused. It's inadmissible but relevant.
Only to the extent that it informed later facts that were, in fact, relevant, Your Honor. It was at that point that Mr. Bush became aware of Mr. Hall as Nasty Nate. 2 days later, when he's shot, he identifies the person who shot him to police as Nasty Nate. Later that same day, when police receive a 911 call, the woman on the phone, I believe it's Tracy G., tells police, Nasty Nate is riding his bicycle in this particular area, and the police respond to that to find the suspect of the shooting, James Nasty Nate Hall.
Now, just so we're clear, all of this was admitted and the jury heard this?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. The facts of the 911 call, the fact that Alex Bush repeatedly identified to police that it was Nasty Nate who had shot him was in the record, was before the jury.
So to repeat, it was historical fact?
Yes, sir. The fact is that this was relevant and probative evidence because it is the only way that Alex Bush knew his assailant. He identified him at trial as James Nathaniel Hall after receiving numerous trial notices. But at the time of the incident, at the time he's speaking with police, he identifies him as Nasty Nate.
Was any kind of limiting instruction given?
No, Your Honor. There was a suggestion during the initial discussion with the court from the prosecutor that this court in Taylor suggested that a limiting instruction should be given. The prosecutor suggested that twice. It never came up again, other than defense counsel saying that Taylor was informed by the fact that that defense counsel had agreed to murder and the limiting instruction.
Well, also, help me on this. Did the defense ever ask for a limiting instruction?
No, Your Honor. After the initial discussion of this prior to trial, and I believe after there might have been some portion after some testimony had been taken, the issue of a limiting instruction was never brought out again.
Well, what was the trial judge's rationale when the prosecutor brought it up for not giving a limiting instruction?
There wasn't a rationale given. There wasn't a ruling, I'm not going to give it. It was immediately defense counsel's turn to respond. It was in the midst of argument. There was never any ruling from the trial court on the issue. It appears it just fell by the wayside and nobody remembered. But in this case, it's clear that he suffered no prejudice from any of this, because as the identification Nasty Nate, which was derived almost entirely from the events of November 6th, he was acquitted of all but the weapons charge from that offense, which was a conviction by the trial court, not by the jury. Clearly, the jury's passions were not so inflamed by this nickname as to render the later verdict in the November 8th shooting somehow unconstitutional or unfair.
So we should assume that where the jury's the trier of the fact, their passions it could be inflamed, but when a judge is the trier of the fact, the use of the term Nasty Nate and what it may imply if you accept your colleague's version, that should not be of concern to us.
Your Honor, this court has recognized that the trial judges are able to disregard evidence that is inadmissible. They hear far more than juries ever hear. In this instance, for instance, there was a phone call between James Hall, who self-identified as Nasty Nate from prison, to a woman on the outside. The trial judge heard that phone call. It was sexually explicit and deemed it inadmissible at trial, even for the limited purpose of connecting James Hall with Nasty Nate. The trial judge could certainly hear this without being so inflamed. If the court has no further questions, the state will rest on its brief. Thank you.
Just one or two points. The process, when we're talking about the police officer who took the information and asked Nate and did a further investigation, what's interesting about that is the judge kept that out as well. So she was told that she was given the nickname Nasty Nate, and then she eventually developed Mr. Hall as a suspect. So a lot of the problems here turned out to be the inconsistency in the rulings, which limited the relevance of the statement. As my colleague says, the nickname Nate versus Nasty Nate to the police officer did make a difference, because the nickname Nate was used, but the jury was never told that, and the phone conversations were never presented to the jury.
So it made a difference, but only as to that one charge in which he was convicted, not the ones in which the jury acquitted him.
Well, I think ultimately he was convicted of the one, but I don't think that the court could say that it didn't make a difference at all, because perhaps they would have acquitted him of everything. So the fact that they did, in fact, convict him of those set of charges indicates that there was some prejudice in this case.
Let me go over with you what I'll just refer to as the nickname cases. Walls versus State. This court's decision, 1989, 568, second 1038, where the nickname Wild Dog was probative to the issue of identification. Allen versus State, 2009, order of this court, finding no prejudice where the defendant was identified by his nickname Hoss. And Cannon versus State, 2008 case, finding no plain error in a witness's testimony which referenced the defendant's nickname Messy. And then Pennewell versus State, 2008 case, nickname Wonka, drawing an inference between the fictional character Willy Wonka's role as the Candyman and the defendant's alleged conduct selling drugs. How do you distinguish these cases?
None of those cases would I say that the nicknames could be construed as being pejorative in the sense of committing crimes. I mean, I think a lot of people, if you've got someone who's charged with a crime and you hear that, as Mr. Bush said, his name on the street was Nasty Nate, I think that the fact that it could mean something like causing severe pain and extremely harmful is clearly a reasonable inference the jury could draw. Whereas in those, I mean, Wonka, that doesn't, I don't think, have someone come to their mind of, somebody evil. And in fact, that's the difference between a lot of the cases that the state cited. With respect to Pinocchio, the judge said, well, it could very well be because of the way he looked. And there could be times when it is relevant to identification. It just wasn't here. And had it been relevant here, then we would be in a different, doing a different analysis, weighing that against the prejudice. But because there was no relevance.
He was identified as Nasty Nate as a matter of historical fact. Isn't that correct? I mean, it's relevant. Well, that two questions. If it is correct, isn't it relevant for that reason?
No. There was no need for that historical fact. The defense attorney suggested what this court said in Taylor, which is they could have asked him, I heard the name Nate, and I gave the name Nate to the police officer. There was no reason for Nasty, because Nasty Nate did not actually help the police identify anybody. They used Nate. And so the defense counsel indicated, through suggesting they just use the name Nate, that they wouldn't dispute that Nate and Nasty Nate aren't the same people. So there really was no need whatsoever. I don't think it was even necessary as a historical fact, given context for anything, given the fact the jury was never told of how the investigation unfolded, and the fact that during their testimony, the witnesses used different names at different times to refer to him.
Now, in Taylor, it was a Second Circuit, I think, case was cited to us where the Second Circuit actually held use of the nickname Murder was unfairly prejudicial.
Yes.
I take it, since you have not cited one, there's no federal or state case that says the use of the name nickname Nasty is inherently prejudicial?
No, there were none in my search. But what I would say is in the murder cases, he was charged with murder. Now, that doesn't mean that a lesser name couldn't be, like Fast Eddie in another case with respect to stealing. The court said that that was prejudicial. So it doesn't have to be devised to murder if you're dealing with an assault. Nasty is bad enough. And so I think that, and actually in that case, United States versus Farmer, there were a couple charges, and they said, well, it wasn't harmful to the one, but it was harmful to the other. So the court does recognize that it can affect decisions, even if they acquit somebody on one of the charges or convict them on another charge if there's abundance of evidence.
Even if, as has been pointed out, as a matter of historical fact, someone told the police it was Nasty Nate, and we accept the argument that, well, it really wasn't necessary because the police ran the name Nate, found the defendant, Nasty became basically irrelevant, and to the extent it was relevant, whatever relevance was outweighed by the potential prejudice. Given all the other facts in the case, isn't this a harmless error analysis that we should perform?
Well, if the court wants to look at harmless error, that's fine, but there is harm here. I mean, the state needs to prove beyond reasonable doubt that there was not any harm. And as I stated before, the fact that he was convicted of the one set of charges the day he was arrested by police versus the set of charges where nobody reported anything, I think a reasonable person could infer that it did, in fact, prejudicially affect him as to that set of charges.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.